This is The State of Things. I'm Frank Stachow. Tal Farlow was one of jazz music's most talented and most mysterious characters. He grew up in Greensboro in the 1920s and 30s, and if you'd have met him then, you'd have figured he would go to work in a textile mill like his father. Perhaps he would have sung in the church choir while his mother played piano. Instead, Tal Farlow taught himself to play the guitar, and that changed everything. Tal's large hands and intrinsic sense of harmony distinguished his sound and earned him acclaim as one of the best guitar players of the late 1940s and 50s. He passed away 13 years ago, but his influence lives on. Tal Farlow would have turned 90 next week. Joining me by phone is Lorenzo DiStefano. His film, Talmadge Farlow, explores Farlow's life and career. Also with me is Michelle Farlow, Tal's widow, and I want to welcome both of you to the program. Thanks for talking with us.
Thank you very much. Hi, Michelle.
Hello, Lorenzo.
Lorenzo, you were inspired by Tal Farlow's music as a young man. What did you hear in his music?
Something I hadn't heard in anyone before. I mean, I listened to a lot of guitarists as an aspiring and later failed jazz guitar player myself, but Tal always stood out as the wildest, and yet there was some rootedness there in the standards, you know, but he just went all over the universe, where other guys sort of stayed within the solar system.
Well, explain that a little bit. You may have failed only because you were aspiring to be none other than Tal Farlow. Had you set your sights lower, you might have succeeded.
No possibilities there. But the film was a way of, frankly, getting past my own, you know, depression about not having the chops, you know, but certainly gaining the appreciation for music and musicians. So it's all part of an evolution. And for me, Tal was a major part of my awakening, really, as a filmmaker and as a music lover.
Michelle, tell us how you first met Tal.
Well, I'm a great music lover, and I was living in London for a good part of the 70s and 80s, but got to visit the States a great deal. And on one occasion, my friend said, well, listen, let's go out and listen to some great jazz. And so we did, and that was about 1979, and that was the first time I met him. And on subsequent trips to the States, whenever he was playing in town, I would try and go to hear him. And that's how we first met. And over the years, and I moved back to the States, we became better friends, and that's how it all started.
What was he like as a person?
He was an incredible person. I mean, he really was lots of fun, was extremely intelligent, kind, gentle. It was just, he was a real Renaissance man. He was a privilege to know him, and to share his life was a great joy.
Lorenzo, give us an idea of how influential he was in his prime in the 40s and 50s when he was really making a name for himself.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, jazz historians all have their strong opinions about every musician. For me, Tal, I approach it from the personal because I was privileged to get to know my hero, you know? And so basically he stands out as a huge leap of the instrument, you know, in my opinion, from its earlier days with Charlie Christian and George Van Epps and people who really introduced it as a solo instrument, you know,
Man.
As opposed to just a rhythm section. And and then he took it. This is, as your introduction said, he should have been working in a textile mill, you know?
Yeah. So what was he doing on the guitar that other people couldn't? And was it really the size of his hands? Because that always comes up in every bio, Tal.
Well, I think Michelle would agree that it was partly biological.
Yeah.
You know, the hands had a huge amount, as George Benson says in my film. Men would have their hands operated on. They'd have the webs cut so they could make bigger chords.
Wow.
And, of course, Tal never needed the operation. So he could reach for complex chords and, you know, instrumentations that others really couldn't get to. That and an imagination and a huge knowledge of song making. His repertoire of standards and his improvisational skill was off the charts, you know.
How did he get interested in music?
Michelle, you know something.
Well, I think his father played several instruments, so he grew up hearing that, and his mother, I believe, played the organ at the local church. And I think it was just a gift he was born with, and he doesn't remember a time when he wasn't fooling around with at least a little guitar or, I think, a ukulele that was converted in some ways that his hands could accommodate it when he was really very tiny. So it was just a lifelong love, and he listened to the radio and taught himself. I mean, he really didn't read music. I mean, he taught himself later. writer, but it was just an innate talent that he, you know, continued to study.
Interesting to think how he became attracted to jazz growing up in Greensboro in the 30s, playing guitar. There were a lot of other kinds of music, I would guess, that he might have heard more often on the radio.
Yes, he always listened to the radio. His father helped him build one, a little crystal set, so that he could get stations that were far away. So he used to listen to all the big bands when he was really very young. And when they would come to Greensboro or wherever he could get to hear them, he would go, Count Basie and so forth.
Lorenzo, you talked to Tal a great deal because the fact is he stopped playing in the late 1950s. And I actually want to play a clip from your film, Talmadge Farlow, where he talks about just all of a sudden, I think all of a sudden, just decided to stop playing.
It's a sort of a myth that that I was unhappy with the nightclub scene. I don't want to talk about the seamy side. I don't know anything about the seamy side. You know, there's the nightclub business. Well, it's not that much of a drag. I mean, well, consider this. I know a lot of people that are doing work that they dislike intensely. So I consider myself pretty lucky.
All right, there we have Tal Farlow telling his story in the film Talmadge Farlow, and filmmaker Lorenzo Di Stefano is with us here now. So he wasn't tired of the nightlife. Why does he say he quit?
Well, this is the big misnomer, and frankly, it was the one that drew me into Tal's story, this myth of the guy who disappeared, you know. It is a catchy thing. We like that kind of thing. When you get deeper, though, into it, you see that it's only partially true in the sense that, and Michelle and I were talking the other day, just reiterating, he never stopped playing, you know. As Red Norvo says in the film, even if you're playing in your own music room, you're still playing. So Tal runs counter to this whole fame-seeking obsession that we're in now, you know.
And, of course, Michelle, you met him when he was playing much later, so clearly he was playing.
Oh, yes, he definitely was. And in trying to get all of his memorabilia and a collection together that I have here, going back and reading all the articles from the 50s on, it's interesting to see how much he played locally. I mean, I'm living in the house that he was living in from the 1950s on, and it's only 40 minutes by boat, an hour and a quarter from New York City. So there were lots of New York big names in music that lived in this area, so they could easily get together and play gigs locally or not too far away. So they really did continue to play, but not where all the critics were necessarily. And as Lorenzo says, it was a good catchy phrase for people to say he disappeared. No, he kept on playing, and but not at the big venues. But in the 70s, and then even more so in the 80s when jazz came back a little bit, you know, he was playing at Carnegie Hall, the JVC, and the Newport Jazz Festival. So he didn't totally disappear, and he certainly played the guitar every day of his life.
But the reason perhaps he let himself disappear from the limelight was it was simply something he didn't seek. Isn't that right, Lorenzo? Let me start with you.
I think so, too. I mean, it came from nowhere. I mean, Tal's span there of intense activity was, what, 10 years, Michelle? Maybe a little longer?
Yeah.
Late 40s, early 50s, starting with Dardanelle and working with Artie Shaw, Gramercy 5, you know, Buddy DeFranco, all the things that Tal, and as a leader, with Verve and Norman Granz and that whole thing. He had a career. His great trio with Eddie Costa and Vinnie Burke, you played a little bit from yesterday's amazing, you know, modernist jazz. So I think Tal's personality also, he's a country boy in a lot of ways. He preferred being a sign painter, which he was trained at out of high school in Greensboro, to all the hoopla. But the instrument, the music, never left him, you know.
Well, and he did explain for you, and it's in your film, and we'll play a clip right now, about what it was precisely, if it wasn't the fame, what it was that drew him to playing jazz.
Jazz musicians, I believe, play probably for their co-players on the bandstand. You know, they play for each other probably as much or sometimes more than to the people out front. You know. Often there's more educated listening going on the bandstand and there is out front. It's sort of a musical conversation. The back and forth of that, I think, is what makes a good jazz performance.
So he was really playing for other players, and the better they were, the more he liked it sounds, Michelle.
I think that's absolutely correct. I think he said it just the way he wanted to. It wasn't, he had no need to be in the limelight.
Did he talk about the way things were going in jazz? I mean, here's somebody who really has a good ear, likes to play with people who have a good ear. Did he ever talk about missing that limelight or missing being with some of those other players? The heyday of jazz when that music, the music he was making, was so popular?
No, I don't think so. I think, he, as I said, he had little need for the limelight, but the better the player that he had the opportunity to play with, the more he liked it, and he could find that locally. And then, you know, when the JVC came along or the concert at Carnegie Hall, he would play with players of his rank, and he was quite happy with that.
And able to adapt to modern styles, and as the styles moved on, Lorenzo, as you were saying, he was right there and ready to play with newer players and different styles as they changed.
Well, I mean, Tal got to play with Art Tatum and people's apartments, you know, and the whole 59th Street scene. I mean, you know, Bird, you know, he was inspired a lot by Coleman Hawkins and Lester Young and horn players. Tal is often referred to as a guy who plays more horn lines on the guitar than traditional guitar lines, you know, which is harder, it seems to me, because it's all over. It's not limited to the strings, you know. But, I mean, Tal is truly unique. The 90th birthday, you know, the fact that Duke University Jazz Archives now has the Tal Farlow film collection, which are all materials from my film, is a great honor and an assurance that Tal's legacy continues, you know.
Playing music, and tell us about his last years, Michelle. Maybe I should ask you, a sign painter, what kind of work was he doing? And
well, I think the days of sign painting were certainly over by then.
Yeah.
And he traveled in Europe a great deal, and to the Far East and Australia, and he enjoyed that. He was a great tinker. Electronics was also a great love of his. And so I think with teaching almost daily, both here and in New York, because we lived in New York as well at the time, he had a very full life.
You ever talk about coming back to Greensboro or his life here in North Carolina?
Oddly enough, I mean, he played there, I think, last in 89. And in 97, just before he came ill, for some reason, I said, I really think we should go visit your family in North Carolina. And so we did, and we had the most wonderful visit to North Carolina. And and it was shortly after that that he was diagnosed with esophageal cancer. So, you know, his last trip home was one of the last trips he took, actually.
I understand, Lorenzo, that Gibson made a Tal Farlow guitar. Tell us about that.
They did. I think it was from the 60s, Michelle?
The first one was done in the 50s, and then there was one in the 60s, and they brought them out again in the 1990s.
It's a sort of signature Tal Farlow model, you know.
Did he have his guitar specially made?
Yes.
And were they...
Gibson wanted to make whatever guitar he wanted them to, you know, that he wanted. And so he would work with them to get the guitar that worked best for him.
Now, I'm thinking if you make a guitar that's perfect for Tal Farlow, it might not be playable for any of us mortals. Is that possible?
Well, they've sold many, many of them, so I think it worked well enough for other people. I'm sure that that was taken into consideration. And there was never a guitar Tal had that he didn't tinker with after he received it.
Did he change the sound at all? Do you think, Lorenzo, the sound of jazz or the way it was played just because of the kind, as you say, if you can play horn lines on a guitar, that may really change the way a group comes together and the sound that it puts out?
Well, the groups became smaller, you know, more intimate. So you didn't need a piano, really. You know, I mean, in the film, we have great good fortune of having Tommy Flanagan in the movie, along with Red Mitchell on bass. They're featured as the Tal Farlow Trio. With a pianist like that, of course, you don't complain. But in general, the guitar taking the lead, Tal was also a superb bass player, and that ability to play bass as well and comp for other players as they're taking their solos. A very generous musician and a huge backbone of a trio with a bass player, but Tal also leading in there with bass line or with no bass player. You know, he could do that as well.
Let me ask you both, and I'll start with you, Lorenzo. Do you think Tal's memory is being preserved? Is it being preserved the way you would like to see it preserved?
Well, I think that it has. You know, Tal is a giant, and I think that history has its own way, you know, with these things, whether we want it fits our paradigm of it or not. I know I've always done what I can to keep my film out there which is a good way. It's essentially his biography, you know, a certain window into his life, probably the most complete we'll ever have, although I hear there's some book projects coming, which are very interesting. I think that it's assured. The music floats through the air at all times.
How about you, Michelle?
Well, I think so as well. I think anybody who's interested in jazz, and particularly jazz guitar, will always find the name Tal Farlow there. I mean, he was a great master and genius at what he did, and he's there to be found and to enrich your life. And I think that's a nice legacy to have.
I want to thank both of you for being on the program today. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Frank.
Bye-bye, Frank.
I want to thank Michelle Farlow, who is married to the great guitarist Tal Farlow, and Lorenzo De Stefano. His film Talmadge Farlow was re-released on DVD in 2006. That's our program for today. Thank you for listening. If you have a comment about the show or want to hear an archived edition of a past program, you can go to our website, stateofthings.org. Want a preview of tomorrow's program? Beaver Queen, Beaver Pageant in Durham, North Carolina. It's a fundraiser for Ellerbe Creek Watershed Association. We'll get a preview of that pageant, which gets underway this weekend. That and, of course, live music. All of that tomorrow on The State of Things. Check us out on Facebook as well. Program's produced by Amber Nimix and Alex Granados, Galvin Wells, and Anna Cassell. Our interns, Robin Copley, is the technical director. Managing editor, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Susan Davis is our senior producer. This is North Carolina Public Radio, a broadcast service of the University of North Carolina, Chapel Hill. I'm Frank Stachow.